This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Hey everybody, the Hockey News Podcast is back. Matt Larkin here with Ryan Kennedy and Ken Campbell. We got three teams left in the NHL playoffs because the Anaheim Ducks, they dropped out last night, Game 6. They fell to a Nashville team that didn't have Ryan Johansson, didn't have Mike Fisher, but I mean, hey, Anaheim didn't have John Gibson, they didn't have Rickard Rackel. I know it's Rickard Rackel, but I'm just going to say Rickard Rackel because I love
the sound of that.
Should
we have a moment of silence for the Anaheim Ducks? Like, and just sit here for a moment and not say anything and just, like, just in homage to them being eliminated?
Yeah, okay. Let's do
it.
Okay. How long's the moment?
You just blew it. Way to go.
Let's do it again.
Okay. That's enough.
Okay.
That sounded like the Honda Center on any given night. Oh.
That's not nice. That's a hockey town.
Duck shit.
Nashville's a hockey town now. Nashville's now a hockey town.
That's right. That's right.
Yep.
I mean, looking at the Ducks, I mean, you know, we saw Ryan Kesler, Ryan Getzlaff had great playoffs until their play seemed to fall off. At the end of that series, they seemed to run out of gas. They're in their early 30s.
Yep.
So watching it, I was just wondering, I mean, Anaheim does have a lot of good young players, but maybe they don't have future superstar young players in their core. So was this the end of a window for the Ducks? Do you think they're going to be back again next year? What do you think is their future?
I think they're going to be back again. Not necessarily in the conference final, but I think they're going to be a team that is going to be one that has to be reckoned with. I don't see Ryan Getzlaff's play falling off precipitously in the next year. Like, and he was a beast. Like, at, you know, there was a time during these playoffs when we were talking about him being, you know, a favorite for the Conn Smythe Trophy if they made the final.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've obviously got good goaltending. Maybe they need some depth in goaltending, probably. You know, I mean, Kesler and Getzlaff are still a force to be reckoned with at the top two. Corey Perry would be the guy I'd be worried about. I'm wondering when that one's going to just run dry because he's shown signs this last year and the last little while that, you know, it may be falling off. But I mean, they're still a good team, and they got some good young players. And if, you know, guys like Nick Ritchie can learn not to be idiots and hit a guy from behind in the numbers, you know, in the middle of a crucial game, but that's all part of a growing process for a guy like that. But I mean, I still think they're gonna be a very, very good team in the West.
I think they're gonna be decent, but at this point, I think next year they're probably first round fodder for a younger, hungrier team, and you know, I would agree on Perry, but I'm also very leery about what 2018 Ryan Kesler looks like, and even Ryan Getzlaff. I mean, this was an amazing year for Ryan Getzlaff, but I wonder how many more of those he has. And what I worry about is the sort of gap where you have those guys on the decline, and then you're probably going to lose a defenseman one way or another this summer, whether it's to Vegas or via trade. And, I mean, maybe you get a good tangible asset that can help you in the present from that trade. Hard to say at this point. But, you know, is Brandon Montour ready to be an impactful NHL defenseman? Is Shea Theodore ready to be an impactful NHL defenseman? I mean, the playoffs, they're a very tough beast, but I thought those two guys, it was kind of an adult dose for them, and you know, hopefully that summer growth will help. But my sort of feeling is like the window of the Ducks as we know them has closed, and the only question is, you know, because they're kind of a reload team, not a rebuild team, how quickly can they get back? I think there's going to be at least one gap year.
I think it's good that you said reload too, because I'm in the middle. I mean, I think this version of the Ducks, this is as good as they're going to get in the Getzlaff era now, the new Getzlaff era. I think he can maintain this level because it's kind of like Joe Thornton. It's not like Getzlaff's game is dependent on blazing wheels.
Right,
he uses his strength
right.
down low, and he's a good passer of the puck. I think those skills take longer to erode. So I think he can maintain roughly this level of play. But at the same time, with him playing at that level, the team still wasn't good enough.
Right.
But what I like about the Ducks' situation is they do have such a surplus of assets. They do have a lot of good young prospects. Yeah, they have Sam Steele and Max Jones, but mainly, of course, on defense.
And I think they're going to get a legit asset via trade. I think they know they have to because of the expansion draft looming. And, you know, as an example, like, could they get a Sammy Vatanen for a James Van Riemsdyk, something like that? Not that the Leafs, I mean, I don't think the Leafs should trade James Van Riemsdyk, but it's an example that's being brought up a lot. Yeah. I do think the Ducks have what it takes. They have the right assets, and what they do need to do is secure another marquee scorer for the top six, I think.
And I think what we're also maybe not mentioning here is that the Anaheim Ducks have one of the best GMs in the NHL. Bob Murray has proven time and time again that he can put together a very, very competitive roster. He does a good job with trades. He knows, you know, he almost traded Cam Fowler, then he didn't. And now, you know, we're hearing Jakob Silverberg in the expansion draft. Well, he's not going anywhere. Then we're hearing Josh Manson in the expansion draft. Well, he's probably not going anywhere either. You know, he seems to be able to have a way and has a knack of putting together teams that are really, really good, and he does a good job in talent procurement, and that's what the NHL is all about, is identifying talent and tying it up and developing it properly and keeping it, and he's done a great job of that. The one other thing I want to say about Anaheim is the thing that they've got to be sitting here this summer thinking is, man, it was there.
Yeah, it
was there. Like, this was a year.
Yeah.
Like, and if you're going to talk about them being back, well, you know, how many times is Chicago going to lose in the first round, you know? How often is, you know, LA going to be down and out? They're actually going to be out down and out for a while, but I mean this was the year. If there was a year when they were going to, it was a crazy year like this one where they might have been able to pull it off, and now it's like, wow, you know, we kind of missed that opportunity.
Well, not only that, but the Edmonton Oilers are going to be loaded for bear next year.
Right.
And, I mean, the Dallas Stars, let's not forget the Dallas Stars. They're going to be a big bounce back team. And then it becomes a numbers game where Anaheim just has to get out of that division. And that's going to be, I think, tougher next season than it was this year.
That's right. And then even Calgary. Calgary's a team on the rise, too. Depending on what they do about their goaltending, it's pretty crazy. So
but Calgary, there's a team that has some really good young players that, you know, if they were comprised properly, they could give the Ducks a problem in the future.
Mm-hmm. So Nashville makes it through, and I mean, obviously they're not going to have Ryan Johansson for the Stanley Cup final, but they're in the final. They've looked great throughout the playoffs. A little pat on the back to us, because we did say the winner of the Chicago series was going to go all the way, and big pat on Dom Loose Chicken's spiky head, because he had the Preds going all the way. But now I'm wondering, looking at the Ottawa-Pittsburgh series, if you're Nashville, who do you want to play and who do you match up better against? Because on one hand, I mean, Pittsburgh, the defending cup champions, they're the more formidable opponent, they're the scarier opponent, but they're also extremely banged up. So maybe you want to exploit a team that has pretty much nobody left on defense. Who do you guys think is the better opponent for Nashville?
I still think Ottawa is the team that Nashville secretly wants to play, simply because the way the Predators move the puck from the blue line, I think, you know, Ottawa clearly very great defensively, with the exception of that time they lost by a touchdown to Pittsburgh. But I think it's a system that can be cracked when you have mobile D-man. I mean, Pittsburgh's struggle here is that their best three mobile defensemen have been out for this series. But I think Nashville has the guys to do that. And then obviously with the way Pekka Rinne is playing, I think, you know, Craig Anderson has been very good for most of the playoffs, but I mean, the Pens got to him, and I think Nashville wins that matchup pretty easily as well.
Yeah, and I think since Trevor Daley's come back, Pittsburgh has been moving the puck from the back end a lot better than they were early in the series when they were missing those guys, and we're seeing what the result is. We're seeing that they can penetrate and get through and get scoring chances and cash in on those scoring chances. So, yeah, to me, I mean, if Ottawa comes back and wins games 6 and 7, then, you know, you may be saying, wow, that, maybe they would have rather played Pittsburgh. But at this point, at this very point in time, like, it just looks to me like I think Ottawa would be the better matchup for Nashville.
Yeah, and I'm most worried about Craig Anderson. And I personally, I called it before game 5. I had a friend who was a Senators fan. I said, watch out, Pittsburgh's going to explode, because I thought Anderson was really fighting the puck in game 4. And I think it's continuing the trend. And who knows? I mean, obviously it's been a crazy trying year for Anderson personally. Like, maybe he's just burnt out. Maybe he's finally just giving way, which is very human. Like, any normal person would, under all that pressure, crazy year with really sad story with his wife. I'm just wondering if he's finally just maybe lost focus or his body is just breaking down. But I don't think he's looked the same the last couple games. And
I agree.
I think they got to him exactly, and I'm worried that they're going to keep getting to him. And either way, even if Anderson gets his play back to what it's been throughout the playoffs, I think he's been good. Not great, whereas the Penguins have two guys who can be great on any given night,
right,
in Fleury and Matt Murray.
And I mean, if Craig Anderson, you know, if they win game 6 and 7, it means that Craig Anderson rebounded. And,
right,
and he's back to being the Craig Anderson we saw earlier in the playoffs. But I think your point is well taken. I mean, if you're going into a series and you're looking at Craig Anderson or you're looking at Matt Murray and Marc-Andre Fleury, which one are you saying has more of a potential to go off the rails? Well,
yeah.
I mean, Anderson obviously has more potential to go off the rails. And if one of them goes off the rails in Pittsburgh, then you've still got a pretty good insurance plan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you look at the center matchup. I mean, I know Colton Sissons did something admirable in closing up that series, but if you don't have Johansson and you don't have Mike Fisher, I'm not sure what Fisher's status is right now, but putting that up against Crosby and Malkin, I mean, Getzlaff and Ryan Kessler is one story, but Crosby and Malkin, yikes.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? The more I think about it, why? Like,
terrible topic.
Get real.
Come on, get real.
As if they wouldn't want to rather play the Senators,
yeah,
than the Pittsburgh Penguins, a defending Stanley Cup champion. Like, who thought of these questions?
Yeah, I don't know.
Wait a second. Oh, it was you, man.
Yeah, I threw this together a little too quickly. We're going to stick on the Penguins. And this is, again, this actually might be another really stupid question. But because I know the Penguins won the last couple games, but I still want to talk about Matt Murray and Marc-Andre Fleury a little bit. And it's funny because even though I'm Matt Murray's like secret admirer, man crush extraordinaire guy, I didn't like the decision to bring him in because I hate the idea of platooning goalies. And I talked to Bill Ranford about it this year for a story because he works with Jonathan Quick. And he said, you know what? We have our one guy. We love that because when you start flip-flopping goalies, teams can smell it. They smell blood. And that's it. Because then you don't have confidence the rest of the series, right? Like whoever's in, then every time he gives up, you know, two goals in the first period, he looks over his shoulder. So I didn't like the idea. And yes, I know Pittsburgh won the past couple of games, but it wasn't like Murray stood on his head. He made, I think, 25 saves, 24 saves. So I don't know. I still think it's worth debating if Murray should be the guy right now, given how well Fleury's played in the playoffs.
Well, I thought it was amazing the blowback on Twitter and in social media. You know, when Mike Sullivan made the decision to go with Matt Murray, it was like, oh boy, he's being outcoached, and this is terrible, and what a terrible move, and oh my goodness, this could blow up the Penguins' dressing room, and you know, whatever. I think there's a couple of things people are forgetting. Number one, that Marc-Andre Fleury truly has no ego, and that he really is like the best teammate in the history of professional sports, it looks like.
He's the most loved
guy.
You know
what I mean? And basically, he's proven it by coming out and saying, look, this isn't about me. You know, it was a great run while it lasted, but now we've got our guy. But I think the second thing is that what everybody's kind of forgetting is that Matt Murray was supposed to be the number one goalie for this team to go into the playoffs.
Mm.
Marc-Andre Fleury, you know, all things being equal, Marc-Andre Fleury would have watched these entire playoffs from the bench,
mm-hmm,
if not for Matt Murray pulling his groin in the warm-ups of game one. So, I mean, like, if they were bringing in some kid that, like, nobody knew about or was unproven or whatever, but this guy won the Stanley Cup last year, like, really? And I mean, the proof is in the pudding. They haven't missed a beat. In fact, they've gotten better. And, I mean, I don't have a problem with the move at all.
Neither do I. I think it was a pretty good, I'll call it a gamble. It wasn't even that much of a gamble for Mike Sullivan. But what's interesting to me is because there's so many players banged up in this series and so many key players, even though Erik Karlsson's playing and playing very well, we know he's hurt, there's such a fine line, and these are two teams that are really well coached, and when you put in Matt Murray in the middle of a series, all of a sudden, Ottawa has to start making more adjustments.
Yeah.
It's a different guy they're facing. You know, they've gotten used to Fleury's tendencies. Obviously, they got to him in the series, and that, you know, brought Murray in as a replacement in the first place. Now they have to adjust on the fly, and it might be too late. Whereas Pittsburgh has the luxury of having a book on Craig Anderson, and they've clearly figured Craig Anderson out, at least in the short term.
So I think it's an advantage that Pittsburgh has structurally that they can go to the second guy and go to a guy that, frankly, the Senators weren't researching. They had no reason to. You know, they were looking at Marc-Andre Fleury, who had been the starter this entire playoffs, and there was no expectation, I don't think, that Matt Murray was going to come back. So I think it's a bit of a tactical advantage that Pittsburgh has, too.
Yeah, and I get the sense, too, that the Penguins coaching staff was waiting for an excuse to get Matt Murray back in there. Like, I don't know that for a fact, but it just seems to me like they were kind of just waiting. And, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, Marc-Andre Fleury stops 33 shots and they win 2-1. You can't take the crease away from him, right?
Well, Mark, what about that one?
But, you know, when he gives up a 4 spot in the first period, as porous and as awful and as pathetic and as, like, absolutely terrible as Pittsburgh's defense was in that situation, and they were. They were bad, bad, bad with a capital B, a capital A, and a capital D. Yeah. They were really bad. But in that situation, what you're looking for is for your goalie to bail you out, and he didn't and couldn't, and that's understandable. But then, you know, you've got the excuse. Well, it's like, okay, we got to change things up. Yeah. And I think they were basically looking for that kind of excuse all along.
I think so, too. And it's just tough. Like, I don't know why I feel like a stick in the mud on this one. It's more just, I don't think that Matt Murray led the Penguins to these 2 straight wins, and it was, oh, what a genius move. It was like, oh, the Penguins won, and Matt Murray happened to be in net, but the Penguins played so well in front of him, I think they would have won with Fleury in net, too. I think that's kind of the point that I'm thinking
about. Well, okay, then maybe there's something to the way they play in front of him. You know?
It's possible.
Maybe they play a lot more conservatively, and they play a lot more tentatively in front of Marc-Andre Fleury than they do in front of Matt Murray because they have more confidence in him. I don't know that
it's
either.
Fair, but it's fair
question.
Not
in their heads, but, I mean, the performance would maybe lend credence to a theory like that, wouldn't it?
And what happens, so if Murray gives up, you know, a 5 spot in game 6, then what do you do? And this is the problem I have with the platoon. Then what happens? Do you go back to Fleury? Because you start the flip-flop. And, or if Murray gives up 3 goals in the first in game 6, is he looking over at the bench now saying, oh, here we go, now Fleury's coming in?
I don't know. I would say that you probably stick with Matt Murray at this point. Because then you start, then it starts looking really desperate. It really starts looking desperate. And then it's like, well, you know, the guy hasn't played in a while. You know, maybe he was due for an off game and, you know, we'll throw him back in. I would think now that Matt Murray is their guy going forward here. I would be very surprised if we see Marc-Andre Fleury the rest of this series or in the Stanley Cup final if and probably when the Pittsburgh Penguins get there.
Unless Murray re-injures his groin. You never know with groins and
groins. Right, exactly.
Anything's going to get aggravated. Yeah. Not re-aggravated, by the way. That would be a redundancy. It's just aggravated.
Well, it depends. If you get hurt, then you aggravate it, then you aggravate it again. Is that re-aggravating it?
I don't know.
Or is that just further aggravating it? Or is it...
Or is it just, are you just aggravating it again?
I don't know. We're probably aggravating a lot of people talking about this.
We're going to go to some reader questions right now. We're going to start with Tiggy Nation at Tiggy Nixon. And Tiggy Nation says, even with the number 2 pick, will the Flyers choke a playoff opportunity yet again? Maybe this guy's a Penguins fan.
Well, I mean the two parts of the question are totally disjointed.
It's a very loaded question.
Well, no, but I mean, even with the number 2 pick, the fact whether or not the Flyers make the playoffs, miss the playoffs, win the Stanley Cup next year, you know, don't win a game, whatever, will have nothing to do with the fact that they have the number 2 pick this year. Yeah. Or very little to do with the fact that they have the number 2 pick this year. That number 2 pick is not going to dictate their destiny next year. Their destiny is going to be dictated by the guys they have now and the moves they make and whether or not Claude Giroux is... like, I think the biggest factor is you look at Claude Giroux, who actually played pretty well for Canada in the World Championship, which would give you a bit of solace and a bit of hope, is that, you know, what Claude Giroux is going to show up next year. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a way bigger factor than whatever Nico Hischier or the number 2 pick is going to contribute or not contribute to this team next year. That guy might not even be playing for them this year.
Well, the one thing that's interesting, and I only found this out recently, because all this time I thought that Nico Hischier was officially on loan from his Swiss League team to Halifax, but it turns out he's actually not officially on loan, which means he is not AHL eligible next year, which actually means that if the Flyers take him at number 2, they might feel more pressure to keep him because there's nothing left for him to do in Major Junior. So it could, in a weird way, it could have an effect. Like, he'll get his nine games, probably either way.
I think the nine games is pretty likely because, I mean, the Flyers have a lot of forwards.
Yeah.
And they're under contract, and those are one-way deals. And, I mean, there's a lot of veteran guys. I mean, the big problem in Philly is goaltending.
Yeah.
And they haven't solved it yet.
Yeah.
And the really good options are starting to dry up, you know? So that would be my biggest concern with Philadelphia is that, you know, they're going to have a very exciting young defense core, and I think that'll help. But if they don't have goaltending, then they're going to be sunk. And if you just look at the way that Metro Division is stacked up, like, we know Washington's going to make it. We know Pittsburgh's going to make it. We know Columbus is going to make it. The Rangers are probably going to make it. So, and then Carolina's looking pretty scrappy right now, even though it's the offseason. What about the Islanders? Will they bounce back? Like, all of a sudden, you have every team in play other than the rebuilding Devils. You have all those teams that you have to contend with if you're going to get back into the playoffs. And you are a team that did not make the playoffs this season. So you have to be better than you were this year.
And getting back to the thing you were talking about with Nico Hischier, Matt, I'm not sure that there's nothing he has left to prove in junior. I mean, it's not like he had 120 points. He had like 90-something or something. But I mean, he can go to the World Juniors. He could be the captain of the Swiss team. He could lead that team. I mean, that team with Nico Hischier on it as an 18-year-old came very, very close to upsetting Russia in the quarterfinal because of Nico Hischier.
Right.
Like, he almost singled.
Team USA.
Sorry, Team USA. You're right. Team USA. The team that ended up winning it. And they said that this guy was the best player they faced in the tournament. So I mean, he can do something there. Halifax was not a good team this year. They lost in the first round of the playoffs, if
I'm
not mistaken.
They did. They were a very young team this year.
Right.
And I would say they actually gave Ruan Aranda more of a fight than they probably should have in the first round.
Right.
A lot of it because of Hischier.
Right.
But if he returned and if he were to captain that team.
So, I mean, there are things he could do. Guys. Like he can help rebuild the program in Halifax. Maybe they win a couple of rounds. Maybe they're a contender next year. So I think that going back to junior would not be the worst thing for a guy like Nico Hischier next year.
I think you sold me. I stand corrected on that one. It's funny, you know, if I'm Ron Hextall in Philly, I was just thinking about the goaltending. What I do is pick up the phone, I call Garth Snow, and I say, "Hey, buddy, remember we were partners together in Philly? How's it going, man? Can you give me Yaroslav Halak just for 1 year?" Boom. Pair him with Michael Neuwirth. You got two Czechs, maybe a little chemistry there.
Halak is Slovakian. Slovak's,
oh, no!
Halak is a Slovak.
Well, what language does he speak?
Well, they basically speak the same language. There's a few different declensions.
There's a dialect.
But I think they both speak English.
Probably. I'm
pretty sure they both speak
still,
English.
They could, they could still be friends. But either
Matt,
way.
Matt, let's face it. Now we're speedbagging you. Speedbagging you on this whole podcast. You're getting speedbagged.
Let's just
face it.
Yeah, I am.
I'm just like,
but Matt, hey, you're out of your element here.
Yeah. Man, oh man. But from a pure hockey standpoint, I think Halak would be
a
perfect stopgap.
I trade myself. But.
Perfect stopgap for Philly, because they're not going to go.
Or perfect let a lot of goals in.
No. Underrated goalie.
Perfect five hole gap.
No.
I think Halak, he would be a step up from Steve Mason. And Halak can steal you games.
Yeah. I'm back.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's the silver.
Way to go, Matt.
Thanks, guys. Next one. The Twitter name is Brower Sweepstakes. That's an oxymoron. At Claytron 8000, I think this is an ironic question, so I'm gonna say it in the voice I think it's supposed to be said.
Yeah, I think they're trolling
Who won the Weber Subban trade, bro?
I think they're trolling us on this one.
But it's still a good question.
Well, the Nashville Predators won it. The Nashville Predators won it by a mile.
Yeah.
Because they're in the Stanley Cup final, and because this trade is going to look better and better for them as every year progresses. That being said, I don't think that one thing would have changed this year if that trade had not been made. I still think the Nashville Predators would be in the Stanley Cup final with Shea Weber, and I still think the Montreal Canadiens would have lost in the first round with P.K. Subban. Short term, probably a soft, but you have to give the win to Nashville because they're in the Stanley Cup final.
Yeah.
And then as it goes on, it's just going to be worse and worse and worse and worse from a Montreal perspective.
Yeah, I would agree in terms of on ice this year, it was probably a wash, and you know what you see, you could switch those guys in Nashville, is probably still there. But I have to wonder if Subban's personality has given Nashville just like that confidence and that fun that, I mean, clearly, like, they needed. It gave them a bit more personality. And I'm not saying that guys on the team didn't have personality, but I think it allowed it to flourish. Like, I think about Ryan Johansson, and I've had some pretty good interactions with him just, like, in dressing rooms. He seems like a pretty nice guy. Good interview, you know, a fun-loving guy. But it feels like if you add Subban in, then with Johansson, it sort of takes pressure off. And it's like you get a really good spirit.
And in terms of personality, Shea Weber and P.K. Subban could not be more polar opposite. So maybe that is, you know what, that is a good point. Maybe it has energized the team, it energized the roster, it's energized the fan base. You may be right about that.
And it's not to take away from Shea Weber's leadership characteristics, but my sort of going theory is like, I wonder what is the culture in Montreal's room this year. And I don't think that, you know, Shea Weber was a problem by any stretch of the imagination, but I feel like there's systemic problems in that dressing room that until they get figured out, and I think it's a culture that goes all the way to the top, this Montreal team is not going to have any success.
Right. And,
well, and the fact that the roster is shit.
There's
that's
also
not helping either.
No, and the way they deploy their roster.
Go ahead, egg, Matt.
I don't think it's that bad.
This hasn't worked.
No, but they won their division.
This hasn't worked
division.
In Montreal. This the Bergevin experiment, the way he tried to build this team, it's not working.
It's not working.
It's not
but
working.
They still won their division, I'm just saying. So it's not like they were
It wasn't
garbage.
A disaster by any stretch of the imagination, but in terms of actually having postseason success, there's just something off about that Canadiens team that whether it's the composition of the players or the way that they're trying to play or the way that the players are deployed, i.e. Alex Galchenyuk.
Yes.
They're just not right.
i.e.
Well, Galchenyuk to me symbolizes everything that's wrong with the Habs. And not in that it's his fault, but just a guy who is a great prospect and they don't know whether to play him at center and left wing and they're publicly talking about him and not knowing whether to give him a vote of confidence or not, and there's rumors about his nightlife. It seems like everything, he's just the epitome of the confusion in that room to me. Time for one more question. This is from just Joe. Nobody else, just Joe. At Improlby, that's his Twitter handle. Any updates on the NHL's attempt trying to get another team for the Western Conference?
Well, it all centers around Seattle, and it's all dependent on Seattle. And there are some interesting things happening in Seattle right now with respect to a new rink. There are two companies, and I believe AEG is one of them, that want to revamp, renovate, to rebuild the Key Arena, which is where the Supersonics used to play, in which case it would become, you know, it would become the main sort of hub for the NBA and the NHL. And then there's always still that southern downtown they called SoDo District. I think it means southern downtown.
It probably does.
Anyways, that Chris Hansen wants to build, and that one's still kind of up in the air because he doesn't seem too keen on building something that has a hockey element to it as well. And you know, I mean, it all depends on Seattle, and as soon as these guys can get their shit together and get a plan to build a new rink, like, Seattle's even more of a shoo-in than Las Vegas ever was. Mm-hmm. Like, that's all the NHL is waiting for now in Seattle is a new rink. And if they can get that, they can get that done and get it together and get going on it, then that's going to be your 16th team in the Western Conference without question.
And I would say that if AEG is involved, that's a very good sign for Seattle hockey fans because they're intrinsically linked to the NHL through the LA Kings and Phil Anschutz. And I mean, you see it in a lot of business dealings where the NHL has trust in certain owners.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen it with Jeremy Jacobs in Boston.
They operate some buildings too, don't they?
They do operate some buildings. Yeah. And you look at like Delaware North Concessions that the Jeremy Jacobs, who owns the Bruins, operates. And even New Lion, which the NHL used for streaming for a long time, that was Charles Wong from the Islanders. That was one of his companies. So there's a familiarity there that the NHL likes. So when you have AEG, there's kind of like a tacit seal of approval from the NHL right there that this is a company we know and this is a company we trust.
Right. And given the numbers, I mean, you got 16 in the East, 15 in the West right now. Does it seem right now like Quebec City's only path to getting in the NHL in the next decade is through relocation?
It doesn't seem that. That's what it is.
Certainly.
That's what it is. They are – Quebec City is going to be a bunch of organizations' fallback plan. So when they want to get a better deal on their rink or they want to, they'll do that. They'll do what teams did with Hamilton 20 years ago. And, you know, I mean, Quebec is Winnipeg. Quebec is Winnipeg. They're going to be a landing place for someone who needs to move and needs to move, like needs to get out of Dodge right now. Like, and that's what happened with Atlanta. They need like the NHL would have preferred not to go to Winnipeg. I can guarantee you they would have preferred that. But when Atlanta was looking for a place to get out and they were looking for a building that was ready, Winnipeg was like, here we are, let's go.
MTS.
And that is ultimately what's going to happen. Whether that takes 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, I don't know. But that's I don't think Quebec is ever going to be an expansion venue. It's going to be a relocation.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, Carolina better start winning hockey games in the next couple of years.
I don't think it has anything to do with them winning hockey games. They got to get their financial...
Right, but I mean, bums and seats.
Yeah, bums and seats helps, but you know what? Bums and seats is one thing, like, but revenues are another, and there's a big difference. You can get bums and seats. You can get bums and seats a lot of times with cheap tickets that's not very onerous or whatever, but you're not generating a lot of revenue. They got to start generating some revenues, and, you know, I mean, there has to be... I mean, he runs the building in Carolina, so... There is that. He's getting a lot of revenues from that as well. So that's another factor. But, I mean, how many times have we said the Carolina Hurricanes are going to move and they have to move and everything and they never do? So
yeah, and it's important to remember, even with Atlanta, the big problem there was that their ownership group was at war with itself and they were divesting and they didn't care about hockey. They cared more about... Well, Atlanta as a city cared more about the Hawks than they did the Thrashers.
Right.
So it wasn't a matter of Thrashers fans disappearing so
much
as...
Which is weird because they were so damn good, the Thrashers.
Hey, the Hawks aren't much better.
Yeah.
It was more of a case of ownership scaring away fans and then just kind of pulling up stakes because they didn't care. Mm-hmm.
Pleasure to welcome six-time Stanley Cup champion, the only man to captain two different franchises to the Stanley Cup, Mr. Mark Messier, here with us today. If you're on the ice right now, working with a brand new player, what would be the most important base skill you think any hockey player should have at any level as a building block?
Well, obviously, if you can't skate, it's hard to play. So, I mean, the quick answer is, you know, you got to skate. I have a friend in New York City that had two young boys, and he wanted to enter into hockey, and he asked me what he needed to do. And I said, well, he's got to skate, and he's got to skate some more, and then he's got to skate some more after that. And then when he's tired of skating, he's got to skate some more. So that is the easy answer. The real answer is that hockey is a master of many disciplines, and one of the most important assets that any hockey player, any good hockey player has is the ability to see the game from a different viewpoint or a different advantage than other players, and playing, we commonly refer to as playing chess instead of checkers. So a deep understanding of the game at many different levels there is also critical. So one without the other doesn't work as well. You could be a great skater and have no hockey understanding and it wouldn't work well. You could have a great understanding of the game and be able to anticipate everything happening, an unbelievable vision of the game, but not be able to skate, and that doesn't work. So it's really, you have to master a lot of different skill sets in order to play hockey. But the initial starter for any player is to get on the ice and get comfortable on the ice.
Good, good. A lot of talk in recent years about, or especially this year, the changing in goaltending equipment. Are you a proponent of shrinking the goalie equipment, or do you think the game is great as is, or are you looking to see more scoring? And if it's not equipment, what would be your suggestion of how to improve scoring right now?
Well, I don't know if we'd you know, I think one of the greatest games I ever saw was a 1-0 game against the Montreal Canadiens against the old Soviet team back in the late 70s, maybe early 80s, in an exhibition game. So, you know, we're never going to get to the levels of scoring that we did perhaps in the heyday when the Oilers were dominating and setting all kinds of goals per game. I think we scored 407 goals, 450 goals, 420 goals. I can't remember the number. The goaltender position, to Paul's point, has evolved to the point where it's almost unrecognizable to what it was when I first started playing pro hockey. The goalies now play a style that was unbeknownst to anybody back then. And because of it, it's much harder to score. Guy Lafleur could not skate down the wing like he did in the grand old days and shoot off the wing and score a goal unimpeded without a screen.
Yeah.
It just can't happen. Even with the technology and the sticks and we're shooting the puck harder, the goalies have that sealed off. So will we ever get... We could change, you know, 100 different... And make 100 different changes of rules there, and we're still not going to get the game to those scoring levels, which is not a bad thing. I think the games are plenty entertaining enough. It's harder to hold on to leads, even in the playoffs. That 2-3 goal lead is not safe, as we've seen. And so I don't think that's an issue for our sport at this particular time, is trying to create more offense. And if there was one thing that I mentioned prior to that, was I always liked the offsetting penalties. And I saw the game the other night where I think there were double minors on both sides, and I think they played 5-on-5, and where in the old days it would have been a 3-on-3 opportunity in the middle of the game there if, you know, two people from each side were sent off for minor penalties. So you would have played a portion of the game at a 5-on-5. You'd play a portion of the game 4-on-4, 3-on-3, 4-on-3, all these different kinds of what like it was back in the 80s there, which I think promotes a little more offense, a little more excitement, because we all have seen how exciting the 3-on-3 is.
That's right.
Implementing that into the regular 60 minutes there is something that might be a think about bringing back, but we'll see.
And you guys dominated with that format as well, of course. I think Oilers when I think of that extra space on the ice.
Well, I always remember Dave Semenko and Grant Fuhr would have a bet every year who would score more points, and Grant Fuhr got more assists stopping the puck behind the net for Paul Coffey to bring it up and hit Wayne Gretzky on a breakaway, and I think one year he had 15 assists and he beat Dave Semenko by a couple points there. And,
jeez.
So pretty amazing.
Well, it's funny because Pekka has got, I think, 3 assists in the playoffs, and he's got, you know, Subban, Roman Josi, Matthias Ekholm, Ryan Ellis. It's kind of the same thing. And I was thinking about the playoffs. A question that I think is really specific to you, because you're a 6-time Cup champion. You see guys break down, and when we interview players, you know, covering the playoffs, we see they're almost sinewy by the end of the playoffs because the body goes through so much punishment. So what do you remember was the best way to sort of just stay physically capable? Because I know it's so hard on the body during the playoffs.
Yeah, and everybody's different. Every body type's different. I remember Kevin Lowe played at the regular season 192 pounds. At the end of the playoffs there, he'd be 176 pounds there over 2 months. So every player is different, just body types for one. It is incredibly taxing to play 2 months of hockey, especially nowadays where 82-game schedule there's no breaks. Every team has to have an incredibly successful year or even in order to compete for the Stanley Cup. Every team is playing on the hard side of the puck every night. Very few nights are you able to take the easy way out and not play on the hard side of the puck. So the grueling schedule of 82 games takes its toll. The parity is taking its toll on the players. And then, of course, the 2 months of much more physical hockey, not to mention the fact of the pressure and the emotional swings that you get over 2 months. And the reality of playoff hockey is that you never really escape from it, even when you're not playing. Even on your days off, you're still incredibly focused and not able to kind of relax mentally. So it's an incredibly tough trophy to win. Probably why most people say it's the most the toughest trophy to win,
right,
for all those reasons, not because of the physical demands, but also the emotional demands as well.
Right. This is probably a tough question. Maybe it's a mean question. Edmonton Oilers, New York Rangers. Who's going to win the Stanley Cup sooner? Next.
Good question. New York has been banging on the door for quite a few years. They've had an amazing run, actually. I think there's only one team in the NHL that has played more playoff games than them, and that's Chicago Blackhawks over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so they've really been consistent. They've had an opportunity. They got to the finals in 1 year. They've lost in the conference finals a couple years. But you can see how quickly things swing. I mean, I remember Ottawa a few years back when they had Char and they had some, Phillips. They had some great teams, mm-hmm. and their window came and closed so quickly. You look at Chicago this year being upended by a young, strong team. You look at what Oilers were able to do this year, exceeding expectations, tenfold of what they thought they could accomplish this particular year. So. To say who's going to win first, I don't know. But mm-hmm. you can see there's a change of guard happening in the league right now with Toronto. Buffalo looks like they're set to hopefully start making some noise. Edmonton, a host of other young teams as well. So you can start to see it kind of start to shift, and it is cyclical. It's always been cyclical, and that's the way it should be.
Good. Last question for you. Connor McDavid, I mean, his career trajectory is already looking amazing, and if you look at the numbers, it compares really closely to early career Sidney Crosby. I mean, not quite Wayne, but Crosby, Mario Lemieux, some of the statistics are right on par. What do you think is the ceiling for McDavid? And have you had a chance to sort of work with him and mentor him at all, give him any advice?
I can't remember a time in the NHL maybe that there's been so many great young players on so many different teams. Mm-hmm. You look at right here in Toronto and the great young players that they have here with Matthews and Nylander and what they were able to accomplish this year. And not only great players, but great kids, the way they've handled themselves. It's extraordinary. And you look at, Eichel in Buffalo. You look at McDavid in Edmonton. You look at the guys that are kind of in the middle of their career, like Kane and Taze, and guys who've been doing it now and won Stanley Cups. Is there a time in the NHL where we've seen that much talent amassed at any one particular time? I'm not sure. Maybe. I guess Lemieux and Gretzky was in that bad area as
79
well.
79 draft.
Ronnie Francis, and he's pretty good as well. But it's exciting. And, I'm not a guy that likes to compare players. I don't think it's fair for anybody because I think everybody has to carve out their own niches. They have to, really kind of develop their own identity. Trying to compare Wayne with anybody is just not the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's never going to be another Wayne Gretzky to even try to compare what he accomplished as a player and what he did for the game. It's just not healthy for anybody. So Connor is a great kid. He's been incredible for the league. He's an exciting player to watch, and we'll see where it all goes.
Good. I know I'm breaking the rule here. It's technically a comparison, but I have to ask because we talk about it in the office all the time. Is McDavid faster than Pavel Bure? To me, that's the all-time comparison, fastest guy with the puck on the stick. And I don't know. Do you see an advantage if you want to answer it?
Well, it's great. It's a great comparison. It's one that I use myself. Is that when's the last time a player came in the league that could get everybody out of their seat when they got the puck? Mm-hmm. Pavel Bure did that incredibly well. I mean, when he got the puck, he was electrifying. And now Connor McDavid coming in, when he gets the puck, the anticipation of the crowd now, because they've seen it, is electrifying, and what he can do once he gets it. So who's faster? I'm not sure, but same level of electrifying kind of style of play, which is great for the fans. Puts fans in the seats.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much, Mark. Pleasure talking hockey with you. And great. Thanks for listening, everybody.